Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this podcast topic is Leader Engagement in Holistic Health and Fitness, focusing on FM7-22, Holistic Health and Fitness. We're also weaving leadership doctrine from ADP 6-22 and FM6-22. We welcome the Combined Arms Center Command Sergeant Major, Command Sergeant Major Steve Helton. Sergeant Major, welcome back to the show, and thanks for joining us.
Awesome. It's great to be back.
Last episode, we talked with Sergeant Major Helton about leadership in the Army and leader development. Today, we will talk the importance of holistic health and fitness, or H2F, and leader involvement in H2F. FM 722 outlines H2F, but I first want to look at leadership doctrine that links leadership and H2F. So in the introduction of ADP 622, the publication defines an ideal Army leader as one who, quote, serves as a role model through strong intellect, physical presence, professional competence, and moral character. Later, you find written, it is a leader's duty to stay healthy and fit, since the leader's decisions affect the welfare of the entire organization. To maintain peak performance, leaders and soldiers need exercise, sufficient sleep, nutritional food, and adequate hydration. Not only do we have a doctrinal link between leader development and H2F, but studies also stress the importance of H2F. So AUSA posted an article called Targeting Mind and Body for Soldier Readiness, where they stated specifically that leaders who embrace the importance of health, resilience, sleep, operational stress control, and family support result in better soldiers and ready units. So Sergeant Major, with studies, evidence, and doctrine that point to the benefits of H2F, why do you think that we still hear skepticism when it comes to H2F implementation?
I think, with anything that's new, I think that there's always going to be some level of skepticism. And I think in the space that we operate within H2F, that there's a whole bunch of different schools of thought within the science that produced H2F as a concept for the Army. So I think you're constantly going to have folks that are going outside of, you know, our doctrine, 722, and then looking at videos. And there are experts and scientists who have sometimes differing opinions about some of the things that we're doing in H2F in any one of those five pillars. So I think it's natural that there's going to be some skepticism, and also because it challenges our culture. I grew up in an Army that did not care about sleep necessarily, did not care about proper nutrition as it related to the optimization of humans, did not necessarily care about mental practice or visualization in order to improve performance. These are all sort of concepts that culturally are probably hard for us to get around. When I mean culturally, like culturally as an Army, it's a million people, you know, across all three compos. You know, there's gonna always be in that group of people, I think, there's always gonna be some folks who have a different idea about it or a different opinion about it.
I wanna give a shout out to CIMT, Center for Initial Military Training, and they have experts who did the research on this. So it's not like we're just pulling this out of thin air, and we aren't.
Yeah, I think you make an important distinction, and that's that it wasn't a bunch of Army folks that sat around a table writing 722. You know, we CIMT, that's a great shout out to our team. They solicited the work of, you know, leading scientists and experts in these fields, and in some cases, you know, like Chapter 7, Poe's Running Method. You know, there are folks that are world-renowned experts that have donated their intellectual property to the Army in order to include in our doctrine. I think once there's a level of saturation, is a word I like to use, in the force where we just incorporate these principles on a daily routine basis in everything that we do. An example, the easy example is always the physical, but when we talk about mental readiness, the incorporation of visualization techniques and breathing techniques, which is not a novel concept in marksmanship, as part of our preparation for squad live fire, as part of our preparation for marksmanship qualification, for crew gunnery, when that's when we've gotten somewhere. When that becomes just part of the normal routine of how we do things, then we know. But that's, we're getting there. It's going to take time for people to understand the value and the payoff. I mean, the science tells us that it works, and that's helpful. But I think the practice has to show the results over time for future leaders to fully embrace it. But, I'll go back to the initial skepticism and countering the initial skepticism with, this isn't brand new to the military. We've been doing a similar thing in the Special Operations Forces for many years. And SOCOM has really championed this capability that's very similar to what we've implemented for many years. So there's a lot of data and science and things that we can look at, within the military structure from SOCOM that tell us that this works. I think if leaders would look at 722, an instruction manual for how to prepare their soldiers physically, mentally, emotionally for the rigors of combat, and then sought out the resources they need to accomplish that, and then operationalized it in a way that made sense with their mission essential tasks and preparation, then it's not additive. It's just part of what we do, right? And I think that's where we're sort of missing the boat right now.
Okay, but hopefully that's what we'll get into today.
Yeah.
So let's talk more about FM-722. So the program has five domains. You've kind of hit a little bit on some of them. It's supposed to improve soldier lethality, physical lethality, and mental toughness. The five domains are physical readiness, nutritional readiness, mental readiness, spiritual readiness, and sleep readiness. So I think it's easiest for those of us in the Army to understand physical readiness and that domain. So I'd like to focus the conversation on the other four domains. And I also think that we should probably preface, we're not subject matter experts.
No.
On this.
We're practitioners.
Yes.
But not, yeah. We're learning just like everyone else, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what domain would you like to start talking about?
I want to start with the physical domain.
Okay.
Even though you said not to.
Okay.
I mean, look, you make a great point, ma'am, and I appreciate it. And we do. We tend to overemphasize the physical domain because what we do is hard. It's hard work. It's physical work, right, for the most part. But what I think is important to at least hit on in the physical domain is that the science in that area, based off what we can read in the doctrine and studies that you can read, is that we're still learning new things about the human body. We're still learning new ways to optimize human performance in the physical space. And my observation, both in the operating force and out in the generating force, is that we are not using the information. The reality is, my observation is that it's only in exceptional units, with exceptional leaders who have already done the things that I want to talk about within their organizations. It's only in those type of units, which are the minority, where I think they're fully taking advantage of the physical aspects of 722 and what it lays out for us and how to build better physically capable. So when I say physically capable, I'm talking about physically capable to do all their hard physical jobs, but also more resistant to musculoskeletal injury, right, more resilient in the physical space, which involves things other than, for example, it's not just doing more push-ups and doing more, it's understanding the benefits of mobility and agility, stretching. And we've always done those things, but 722 lays them out in a way that's a little bit different than we've done in the past. And then understanding the resources that we have available to help guide our leaders, in particular our NCO leaders, in how to develop those programs. And we call that programming in the physical space, right? How do we do physical programming? Well, I don't think we abdicate that responsibility to a physical therapist. I think, you know, the physical therapist as part of an H2F team is a resource for leaders to help build good programs that actually get after the commander's intent on where they want their soldiers to be in the physical space. But I just think, you know, we will miss out if we don't at least talk about how it's different. And at least since I got the mic, you know, my observations on how we're doing it wrong, and haphazardly getting after PT. I mean, one of the fun things I get to do whenever I travel is just blend in with the formation. I do that. We're Army PTs, and I'll just show up at a formation, and I'll do whatever PT they're doing. Unfortunately, I would say 90% of those PT sessions that I've done like that have been spur of the moment, unplanned, uncoordinated. It's exercise, and it's taking advantage of the time, but I don't think it's fully maximizing that dedicated hour and a half that we commit to the physical space every day. And we commit zero space to the mental. You know, when you talk about mental readiness, I mean, we don't block out any time in the day for, you know, mental practice, right? We don't maximize the opportunity to drive the physical optimization of our soldiers towards a goal or end state. It's, in other words, I don't feel like it's planned. There's no test, you know, for, you know, like planned in, you know, made an 8-week cycle. We're going to do an ACFT and we're going to assess, you know, the efficacy of our fitness physical program, right? In conjunction with the expertise of the occupational therapist, the physical therapist, strength and conditioning coach, and the athletic trainer. Because you'll have some athletic trainers and some strength and conditioning coaches. Now, that all being said, and maybe this is sort of my final comment on this, I guess, is not all units have these capabilities. And frankly, not even all units are gonna ever have all those capabilities. But 722 lays out what we're supposed to be doing, just like the old PT manual lays out what you're supposed to be doing. And if that requires resources, and so I used an example earlier of really good leaders who do this in their units, and some of those don't have any H2F assigned capability, you know, the team. But what they've done is they've leveraged available resources on their camps, posts, and stations, and they understand the methodology that's laid out in 722, and they're getting after it with what they can, and they're empowering leaders at Echelon to do it that way. I will just say this. Read 722. Don't wait for stuff. Don't wait to get fielded. Start executing the doctrine to the best of your ability and take full advantage of that time that we set aside every day for our soldiers to do physical training.
Which dimension do you want to talk about next?
I don't know. What do you got next?
I think we
can talk about sleep. You want to talk about
sleep?
I like
sleep a lot.
Sleep is for the weak, ma'am. Right? That's what we always hear.
Yeah, but that's kind of what I want to talk about is we hear that, but our brain needs sleep.
Yes.
You know, the doctrine says, let's see, sleep readiness is defined as the critical requirement for brain health and function. It underpins a soldier's ability to meet the physical and non-physical demands of any duty or combat position, accomplish the mission, and continue to fight and win.
I can't say it any better than that. And that's a reality. So look, it's awesome that we're talking about this because I don't know if it was ever laid out in doctrine anywhere ever before, other than maybe, you know, like, you're an aviator, I have aviation background as well. So we sort of understand the cognitive load and you know, an early understanding of a requirement to have some regimented rest cycles, right? Mm-hmm. Not all organizations do that or did that. But we put it in doctrine, so we're making it important and we're talking about it, and that's important because that's exactly what you said is exactly true. I think that particularly when we think about the future, which is we do a lot of that here, and you think about what the future of warfare looks like, and I know you've had others on to talk through, you've had them on the podcast to talk through the future of future warfare concepts. You know, the pace that it moves at, the requirements of individual soldiers in a increasingly lethal and observable battlefield, it's irrefutable that those requirements are going to be cognitively tasking. You know, you're going to be mentally beat down. If you don't figure out in training how to organize, you know, at least to recognize the risk of not doing it, organize sleep schedules to maximize the performance of your operators, then I think you're way behind the power curve. I think being able to operate under less than ideal conditions is a known. I think that's always going to be the case. But when you put a premium on what you just said, the cognitive aspects of being sleep deprived and the ability for your brain and physical body to recover during sleep, you know, that the science tells us is how it works, mm-hmm. Then I think you'll figure out how to best employ your forces, right? Like, it's not always going to be perfect, but at least you're going to know, hey, look, my expectations are maybe X because I wasn't able to, you know, understand the risk, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
If you're not able to do that, the risk increases, right? Of not being able to accomplish the mission or to injure your folks or any number of things.
When I was reading through the sleep dimension, one thing that I was thinking about was large-scale combat operations.
Yeah.
But in large-scale combat operations, you're not going back to a FOB within a couple of days.
That's right. You're constantly on the move.
To be in your, you know, your hooch, as we would say it. So some of the effects of inadequate sleep on the brain function, you know, just thinking about it through that large-scale combat operations, you know, you have reduced motivation, increased reaction time, you can't deal with stress as well, increased risk of physical injury, increased time for recovery from injury, and, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, in practice, we have a great, you know, our CTCs are a great place to challenge our organization's ability to operate mm-hmm. under stress, right? And I think we see this regularly through every rotation at any of our DIRT CTCs where soldiers and leaders are just so exhausted that they're just not, you know, they become almost combat ineffective. And in some cases, actually combat ineffective due to a lack of recovery, right? So, you know, it's not always sleep, but it's certainly recovery, whether it's equipment. We always factor in, you know, when are we going to recover our equipment? How are we going to maintain our equipment? You know, because it becomes about that. But what about the human body, right? What about the humans that are going to be assaulting the objective? And the reality is that it really is only now that I think we're putting words to our thoughts on, you know, how to do that. You know, it's never going to be perfect, because the demands on our organizations in combat are incomparable, I think, to anything else. But that being said, you know, there are some things that I think that we could do better as leaders. And, you know, one of those things is, you know, we've got to model those type behaviors.
Yeah,
you know,
I think
understanding that you have, you know, kind of goes back to our leader development discussion from before. You know, if you've done the right thing and you've developed, you know, folks that can fill in for you and you can take some downtime to get some sleep, to get some rest, to get some recovery, you got to do that. You got to figure out how to do that, because you can't be one deep, especially as a commander or as a sergeant major. You can't be the one linchpin in the whole operation, right, that requires you to be up 24/7 to make every decision. You've got to train and develop your organization so that you have some depth to be able to make good decisions and to continue to make good decisions over the long term, right? So maximizing that cognitive capability by just, one, modeling the standard that you want your organization to do, and then understanding the risk of not doing that so that you can at least make decisions about, you know, where you're gonna, what you're gonna do next or what you're capable of doing next. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's critical. We got a lot of work to do. We got a lot of work to do to change the culture in this space on sleep.
Yeah.
You know? Aviators get it. I think that's about it. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I can think of times when I was in non-aviation units, and I remember a leader who was so sleep deprived that really couldn't even, like, you could see him trying to form words and they just weren't coming out. Yeah. It was.
I've been that guy. I've actually been that guy. So, you know, I wouldn't have known it at the time. But
yeah, you have no idea that it's going on.
Knowing what I know now, that was absolutely 100% the issue. The problem becomes, I think, in combat, you know, a matter of adrenaline and crash, you know, and so I think, you know, I would encourage folks to invest in gaining some knowledge in that aspect, you know, the biological functions that have to reset and recover, and it only happens while you're asleep. I think that's really important. And also, really, the kind of nutrition that you need to facilitate that while you're asleep, right? So,
okay.
I mean, that's a whole nother.
Let's talk about nutrition, nutritional readiness then.
Well, was that my segue?
You just segued us to nutrition. Okay, so nutritional readiness. I personally think the writers of FM 722 did a good job emphasizing that nutrition is not just calories in, calories out, which, you know, it's true, but it's not everything. They talk about nutrition being about prevention, performance, treatment, and recovery. So can you expand on that view of nutrition, what it means to you, or what leaders should think about when it comes to that?
Yeah, so in all transparency, my wife is an H2F dietitian, so she helps me understand, you know, sort of at the tactical level, the operationalization of having a dietitian in your unit. But that being said, you know, I think the Army has always kind of understood that the concept of, you know, an Army moves on its stomach, right? You know, we've always put a premium on hot chow in the field, hot chow for soldiers as a morale, but it's also, you know, clearly, you know, that's the fuel that we need for humans. But I think a deeper understanding that we gain through H2F and having a dietitian as an advisor that helps us operationalize those concepts. But the reality is, the better we do this, the more we'll think about things like, okay, if I need my organization to be ready at, you know, 90% capacity to do this mission, then, you know, you backwards plan from that, from a hydration and nutrition perspective, then you're going to operationalize where you need to have chow, where you need to, whether it's, you know, field expedient chow, you know, whether it's MREs, whether it's Gatorade or Drip Drop, and what the effects of those things are, and where you can maximize both hydration and nutrition given the time that you have in preparation for a mission. So I think there's a lot of work that we could do other than just make our dietitians the caretakers of the body fat program. You know what I mean?
Oh, is that kind of...
Well, that's my observation. In units that I visited that have an H2F team, the dietitian typically spends a lot of time really doing counseling for folks that have been, you know, not met the height and weight standard or the body fat percentage standard, which is an important aspect. It's an important assessment of one's health. But I think where we miss the boat is how commanders and NCO leaders, I don't know, mentor or coach their dietitian to help them understand where what they provide can enhance the operation, right? So operationalizing nutrition is, I think, a critical aspect of the future of our H2F capability. Mm-hmm. I think, and some of this I get from my wife, admittedly. You know, she helps me understand these type things. Look, at the end of the day, that's a professional resource if you have it integral to your unit, or whether it's, because it's available. There are dietitians at every camp post station in the hospital or resilience center or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, they're out there and you have access to them. They can really help you understand what right looks like as, you know, you said calories in, calories out. It's a very simple, you know, it's oversimplified methodology for thinking about it. They can help you understand what the right calories in and right calories out are in order to optimize your performance. So, yeah.
And just to give our listeners a plug to actually go into the doctrine, with the prevention piece, you know, it talks about having good nutrition increases or decreases risk of injury.
Yep.
Having good nutrition helps in your recovery. So if you have somebody who just had surgery,
yeah,
figuring out that balance of how many calories that they need and what nutrition they should be getting to optimize their recovery, I think that's interesting. So on an individual basis,
yeah,
of using that dietitian in the H2F.
Yeah, I think it's critical because I think there's a deep science to this that I don't think it's fair to expect, you know, every junior leader to understand and to really be thoroughly educated on. But that's why the resource is so important, because there is a deep science to this. We can do better. But at the end of the day, what I wish I would see is more NCOs spending time with soldiers in the chow hall, you know, making sure they're making reasonable choices that affect the operations, whatever they're training that day. I mean, imagine if you would, you know, you spend as much time concerned about, you know, it goes back to our discussion about physical, we're good at that thing. If we spend as much time as a junior level leader helping our soldiers and subordinates understand better choices as it relates to that next hard thing they're going to have to do that day, as we did in the physical space with their, you know, whether it's running or rucking or whatever,
yeah,
you know, if we would just do that and help make better choices, and frankly, our dietitians also help us develop those menus in the chow halls. They're integral part of our food service enterprise. Yeah.
You had said leaders going to the DFAC or,
yeah,
or your dining facility with their soldiers. Now, I'd like to hear from an NCO perspective, how invasive should those leaders be when it comes to, you know, nutrition and eating right?
Yeah.
You know, because I think about like the Chopette. You go there from the end
it's
of
the
PT
worst.
To work call.
Yeah.
And people in line have sugar, more sugar, more sugar, caffeine,
yeah,
more caffeine. You know, that's what, you know, when I'm grabbing my coffee at the Chopette, that's what I see. Should leaders?
Yes.
Be okay.
Yes. So, I mean, I don't want to, I don't know, I don't want to be disconnected from reality on this, but, you know, my opinion is that there is no amount of invasiveness that's inappropriate in this space if, you know, there's a caveat,
mm-hmm,
if what you're trying to do is centered around making your people better. If you care about your soldiers, you care about their health and their performance and their well-being and their mental health and all the things, you know, amongst all five of these pillars, then there's no amount of invasiveness. I mean, you know, I guess the trick is you don't have to be a jerk about it, you know, but if you see your soldier eating, you know, three tornadoes and a monster for lunch, I think that's grounds for you know, and depending on what their performance. So look, I mean, you may have a super high performer in all aspects of their duties that just didn't have time to do anything else, and really that's up to you to make that judgment call. Like there's a certain amount of maturity of leadership that'll help guide you in these interactions. But if all things in your assessment are that's a horrible decision for a lot of different reasons, then you should engage that. I think you should engage that person and at least help them understand how they're reducing their own performance, how they're reducing their own ability to be better, they're reducing their ability to accomplish their mission, their productivity. I mean, I guess it depends on whether or not, you know, the soldier cares about that.
Yeah,
and I acknowledge that. But I don't think you're off base as a leader if you're grounded in the doctrine in this case, and your understanding is at least at that level, and you're offering development, because that's what you're dealing.
And showing, hey, I care about you.
That's the magic, I think. It's, you know, sort of like if you go back to the leader development discussion, right? It's have you established trust with your people? Do they believe that you're a credible leader? Are you modeling the standard? Are you doing all the things? So if you are doing all the things you say you're doing, you can do. If you're a resilient person, you're physically fit, you're mentally capable, and they see that every day, then I don't know if it's invasive for you to offer them advice. I think if you're not that, any of those things, if you're not practicing your own as a leader, if you're not practicing your own holistic health and fitness, it's a tough sell. I mean, that's the reality, right? If you don't have credibility in the space, then you're going to be less likely to have impact in that space when advising others.
Okay. We have mental readiness and spiritual readiness.
Oh,
left.
Man, tough. These are tough.
These are tough ones, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know.
Which one do you want to talk about
we
first?
We talk about mental readiness. I think I say they're tough because, you know, again, we're kind of overcoming culture, right? And we're changing culture. And H2F is, in my opinion, is really transformational in this space, right? So there's plenty of science that says that visualization techniques matter and they work, right? I mean, professional athletes, special operators in the military, high-functioning, high-performing corporate leaders, corporate innovators, scientists all use visualization techniques or mindful practice in order to enhance their cognitive ability, their creative thinking, and their performance. So, look, I don't know, what I've read says the brain doesn't know the difference between visualization and actual practice. Like if you can do effective mindful practice and visualization, meaning there's a science to it, there's probably some practice you got to do to do it right. At least there was for me. Then your brain doesn't know the difference, and so you're getting sets and reps, theoretically, in your brain. At least that's what I've read. So, you know, we've done some tests. There's some studies that we've done within TRADOC that show a marked improvement in marksmanship scores when we incorporated visualization techniques prior to qualification ranges. That's an example that I would use. I don't know how well we're doing with incorporating this into, you know, the operating units in the Army, right?
Yeah.
Because you hit on it earlier.
I think, too, there's...
Time.
We're used to time.
Yeah.
But we're used to task condition standards.
Sure.
You know, there's no test that you take. There's no multiple choice exam that spits out, hey, this is what your mental readiness is.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of... you know, one of the harder pieces also is how do you measure it? Because we want to, you know, measure everything in the Army. I do want to talk maybe more from a leadership perspective on this one, though.
Sure.
Let me go with the definition for, you know, because we got to talk doctrine.
Yep.
So 722 says mental readiness is an individual's or team's ability to think, feel, and act in a manner that optimizes performance in a demanding environment or with occupational and combat-specific tasks. And then there's the three kind of pieces of it. It's cognitive, emotional, and interpersonal capabilities that encompass mental readiness. So looking at the cognitive piece, I see a lot of overlap with the leadership requirements model that you find
sure.
in the 622 series. So, you know, you talk about intellect, mental agility, and judgment. Those are all
right.
kind of nested in cognitive skills. You know, you can go to FM 622, and it's a great resource to find growth plans for all of these cognitive skills. But, we're not always looking at doctrine. So from more of a practical day-to-day standpoint, how do you see leaders promoting mental agility, judgment, sound decisions, et cetera, in that cognitive piece?
Yeah, I think number one, you gotta model the standard. That's always first with me. You gotta mm-hmm. be, You got to be a practitioner of whatever it is that, that you're trying to move your organization on. And in the cognitive, mental space, I think that it's not necessarily about doing like yoga or even, you know, I talked about visualization.
Mm-hmm.
But understanding that there are techniques in order to improve in those type areas, right? So, you know, performance under stress. You know, how do you, I know how I have used breath control as an example to improve my ability to operate under extreme stress. It's a real thing. There's breathing techniques. These are all teachable skills, right? So mm-hmm. I think as leaders, we've got to one, embrace that these things work and they matter and they optimize performance. You know, that's what it says, optimize, right? And that they optimize performance in these different modalities. If you do that, then I think, and you understand that these are teachable skills, then you incorporate them into your training methodology. And while not always included as a table of, you know, as a table of qualification, understanding that these things improve qualification as an example, then you would incorporate them into your training methodology, right? So, but I, you know, one of the great things is we have incorporated occupational therapists into our H2F capability.
Ooh.
Again, not everybody's got them, but the occupational therapists who specialize in this field are available for all of our leaders on camps, posts, and stations that you can access and understand how to build those skills, right? So, I don't know. You know, I think it definitely manifests itself in people's leadership styles. You know, when you're under duress or you're under stress, do you engage with people the same way as when you're not? Are you able to, you know, be aware enough to cognitively correct when you're under stress and be able to still maintain order and calmness under mm-hmm. under pressure, and show your people that, you know, you got it all together. I think, you know, as a SAR major, you know, I've always been told, and I've always used the same terminology, is, you know, you never want to let them see you sweat. That doesn't mean not sweat, but it means like I always want my soldiers to see me calm in the face of adversity, because sometimes you, as either the SAR major or the leader at any level, you're the only one that's calm. They're looking at you, they're watching you, they're
right.
Needing someone that's calm so that they can calm themselves and execute, right? So that's not possible. And because you know the human brain is what it is, and it's not, my opinion is, it's not possible unless you've developed some internal personal techniques to manage stress. And if you've done that, then you're modeling the behavior, right? I mean, I don't know yet how we incorporate the training in these techniques, right? I know it's in there. It's in the doctrine. But I know that we got to start in ourselves as leaders, making sure that we have our technique. And most every good leader I've ever known, that's been a foundational quality, is their coolness mm-hmm. under pressure. Their ability to make well thought out decisions under tough circumstances, and maintain a sense, or at least an appearance, of calm, cool demeanor, right? And then they become the bedrock, and the organization functions off of that. You know, and I think that's a critical skill. So from a leadership perspective, this is a pretty important capability.
I thought this was interesting to me. This is an ADP 622. Poor physical fitness multiplies the effects of stress, eventually compromising mental and emotional fitness. So kind of the reverse, you know, we're thinking about mental fitness right now. We're talking about that. But it's all combined.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. So I think conceptually, None of these things exist on their own. I think we don't have the luxury, frankly, to think of them as individual things. I think every one of them affects the other. They all are intertwined. Maybe it's more of a Venn diagram. I don't know. You draw it out that way, maybe. But, one of the reasons why we spend so much time, I think, in the physical space, it's my opinion, is that because the physical overlaps into almost every other aspect of our duties and requirements as soldiers. And it's sort of laid out in what you said, the physical affects your mental state, it affects your emotional state, affects your ability to recover, it affects your ability to operate under stress. So yeah, absolutely. I think, it's important to understand that the physical dimension or the physical pillar or physical readiness is foundational to all the other aspects of holistic fitness. Yeah.
Okay.
I agree.
Last one.
But I don't want to overemphasize like that physical is the only thing. But what we do is a physical business, it's a physical profession.
Yeah.
So look, there's naturally going to be a requirement to be physically fit. But it's more than that. It's more than just being able to lift heavy stuff and run real fast. I think it's being able to recover quickly. It's being able to be agile and flexible. You know what I mean? It's all these other things to recover physically and mentally. So I think we're on a good path.
Let's talk about spiritual.
Yeah, we hadn't talked
spiritual
about spiritual readiness.
That's the last dimension that we have. So the doctrinal definition of spiritual readiness includes the development of the personal qualities needed to sustain a person in times of stress, hardship, and tragedy. These qualities can come from religious, philosophical, or human values and form the basis of character, disposition, decision-making, and integrity. What stood out to me when I was reading the doctrine are the two things was resiliency and character.
Mm-hmm.
Were the two pieces that stuck out to me.
Yeah.
And, maybe you would say differently.
No, not differently. I think as we relate this discussion to leadership, the spiritual aspects that are defined in 722 absolutely overlay with our leadership doctrine. I mean, you got to believe in something, right? I mean, we spend a lot of time in the initial entry enterprise of the Army inculcating Army values. And the reason we have to do that, I mean, frankly, we all enter the Army from different places, different families, different values, different opinions. However you were brought up is what you come into the Army with. So you got to set a foundation, right? And I think that foundation is set through our Army values. So you got to believe in something. I believe that. I believe you got to believe in something. And if you believe in something that's bigger than yourself, then likely you're going to perform better and react better and recover better and be more resilient, I think, in the long run. I don't know. We're still trying to figure that out. How do we train resiliency? How do we train without catastrophic events, how do you train resiliency, right? How do we train people to be able to bounce back from adversity? And I think the foundation of that is having some spiritual foundation, whether it's religious or family or values-based. Either way, you've got to have some set of principles, I think, that guide you in your day-to-day life and everything that you do.
Yeah. 722 says kind of that it's core beliefs, principles, ethics, morals that empower you.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of what you're saying, that foundation that empowers you.
Yeah, well, and I think in our profession, it has to be universal. Like we all have to be working off the same set of values, right? As a profession, which we are, then, the core values starts there and then hopefully those core values also interlace with your own personal and family values, morals, that then drives, I think, your character. And then ultimately the decisions you make under you know, difficult circumstances that affect people's lives. You know, we talked about in the last podcast, we talked about the circumstance, life, and it's life and death, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you can't make those decisions without a strong foundation in belief in something greater than your own selfish interests, I guess. Yeah. You know, I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah, I think there's a critical aspect to H2F that's often overlooked because we look to our chaplains and other resources to really help us understand the spiritual domain, and I think that's important. I think we got to do a better job of incorporating our chaplains into the H2F proper. When we talk about H2F, if the spiritual readiness pillar or domain is, and they're all equally important, then I think our chaplains have to be a part of that H2F capability, if you will. Hey, chaplains are always, you know, in my experience, have always been an important part of every organization I've ever been in, mm-hmm. and continue to be. And frankly, as a sergeant major, I often find myself spending like meaningful time with the chaplain as we sort of think and concern ourselves with similar things when as it relates to soldiers, wellness, and, you know, the capability and health of our soldiers. So, you know, that relationship sometimes becomes symbiotic between sergeant major and chaplain. Different perspectives, but, you know, we're looking at the same things in conjunction. So, yeah, I think that we got to get our chaplains more involved in H2F, specifically as part of the holistic health and fitness program, but in addition to all the other things that they do for our organizations.
I want to talk about back to the resiliency piece. So I think that both you and I could say, hey, that's a resilient person. You know, we look at somebody and say, the way they handle stress, they're calm or cool under pressure, or they've gone through these really tough situations and again, they're staying calm and cool.
Yeah.
So that's on an individual piece, but we talk about resilient organizations. So how do you think you can identify a resilient organization? What does that look like to you?
I mean, there's lots of metrics we could look at. I mean, I don't want to oversimplify it, but in the past, we always look at things like retention rates or you know, DEOC surveys. Or, I mean, there's a lot of different tools that we use professionally to try and assess the health of our organizations.
And that's what's hard, I think, about this, is because you want to go straight to metrics.
Well, yeah,
just naturally. How else do you,
yeah,
you know, assess the resilience of an organization?
I mean, maybe this is the question: Does an organization respond to tragedy in a positive or in a negative way? We saw a lot of those type of situations, you know, in the last 20 years of persistent conflict where organizations suffer losses and then, you know, got to get right back in the fight. I think if we relate resilience as a military concept to, you know, the future of warfare, you know, the potential for catastrophic loss makes resilience really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability to develop resilience, I think, is founded in the same things that we talk about when we talk about building good military. We talk about building trust, you know, developing leaders, empowering leaders, you know, all the same things that we talk about when it comes to building quality organizations and leader development from our last conversation, I think apply in this case to building resilient organizations, because one thing can't tear down the whole organization. You know, you got to be able to bounce back from tough situations and loss. I think if my soldiers knew that I cared about them, that I genuinely cared about their well-being, their welfare, then those type of things improved. You know, whether we had, you know, a suicide or you know, an accidental death or a death in combat, you know, having leaders that care, that that are also resilient, that understand how to communicate to their organizations effectively and guide them through challenging situations so they get back on track. And then, hey, you know, I guess at the end of the day, you've got a rep in, right? I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but I know that for sure, resilience in an organization is built through leadership, and mm-hmm. it's probably, you know, you got to have some sets and reps of challenge, right? So you've got to push your organization to do hard things, to train hard. I'm not saying like deaths or, you know, but like just forcing your organization to do hard army stuff, to get back to the basics of being able to survive in the field and operate under challenging conditions builds resilient organizations. That's my opinion. I think we got to train hard in practice. We got to train hard in garrison so that, you know, when combat comes, we're ready for it, right? I mean,
yeah.
We haven't had a lot of discussion, I guess, in the resilient space as it relates to, you know, like tough, realistic training. But I think that's the foundation of organizational resilience in the Army is tough, realistic training. Like getting back out after the basics, practicing, you know, hard field craft, doing without, having a little bit of privation, you know, like living in a tent or in a hole in the ground for a couple of days and doing what you do builds teamwork, builds trust, and ultimately I think builds resilience. So that's a lot of words to get to that.
But I think what you're just saying is back to the Venn diagram per se of H2F. So you're building, when you're doing those tough things, it's not just spiritual readiness, it's also mental. You're practicing your sleep.
Yeah, or not.
Physically, and then nutrition's in there too.
Yeah, I mean, it's been my whole career, the best stories I have are stories when things were hard, when it was tough, when we were either deployed somewhere or in training somewhere I guess it goes back to the conversation about how corporate America does team building, you know, like they take people out and they make them suffer together.
Yeah.
The shared suffering builds a camaraderie. I believe in that. I believe that to be true. If you train hard and you drive your organization hard, but with a thoughtful understanding to what it takes to recover the soldiers and their equipment and their families, then you build the type of organization that is resilient because they bond and they're reliant on each other for support and they take care of one another. They look out for one another. They accomplish all these other things that we've talked about because they care about one another as opposed to, hey, it's my job to tell you what to do. Sort of like that discussion we had about, you know, how invasive should you be? Well, again, I think it's not invasive when there's stress, especially at the, again, I keep going back to the lowest tactical level, but you know, young NCOs with their soldiers, the best ones I've ever seen are ones where they have genuine care and rapport with their soldiers. And then it's not invasive when you say, hey, buddy, that's not doing you any good, man. I want you to be better. You want to be better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's a resilient trait, I think.
Okay. Last thing I want to talk about is time, priorities, balance.
Mm.
So I'm going to throw in some FM70.
Fun.
Yeah, my favorite. It talks about leaders fostering a culture of holistic health and fitness in FM70.
Yeah.
It talks about H2F being an individual task alongside Army warrior training, weapons training. So what perspective should leaders take on finding time to cultivate the individual training of H2F while balancing collective tasks, getting after the unit's METs, which are often, you know, those METs, that's what people see.
Yeah, it's like the report card, right?
Yeah. So what's that balance, do you think?
Oh, I don't think it is balanced. That's my going in on this. I think, one, you're going to hear over the coming, you know, the coming years, I think we're going to hear a lot more about getting back to the basics. And, what you know, that means something different at Echelon to every mm-hmm. leader. But if we fundamentally agree that H2F is on an equal footing with individual soldier training and readiness, you know, as it relates to warrior tasks and battle drills, and foundational level of soldier readiness, then it's not really even a matter of how you fit it in. It's a matter of, or if you fit it in, it's a matter of how you fit it in, right? And frankly, it goes back to our earlier, you know, the first discussion we had in this podcast was my opinions about, you know, the lack of preparation in the physical space that I've experienced as I've done some battlefield circulation over the last couple of years. We got to stop winging it. We've got to maximize the time that we're dedicating to these things. And you know, the easy discussion is in the physical space because, frankly, we allot time every day for every soldier to do physical training. And if we don't plan that physical training with the same level of effort and resourcing that we do a collective event, then we'll never get the results that we need to get in order to enhance the collective events later on. So I have a theory about how we plan and train organizations, you know, really up to the brigade level and how that relates to individual skills. And so, you know, when I was a division CSM, it was pretty obvious to me that in our semi-annual training briefs to the division commander, that there was not adequate time for the non-commissioned officers to clearly articulate their ability to meet the individual crew, small team training requirements that nested with those clearly depicted collective events on the training calendar over the next year as it led up to either deployment or to CTC rotation as like a culminating event, right? But we had to have that discussion. And I'm not saying that what I did was right or anything. I just, as a technique, I just decided that I needed to have that same discussion, but at a lower tactical echelon than that, in order to make sure that our non-commissioned officers were able to clearly articulate the risk of doing or not doing something at the individual crew small team level. Because you can't mortgage, well, you can. Actually, frankly, you can. You can mortgage all of that due to time and only get after collective events starting at, you know, like squad live fire maybe. But if you do that, you know, it's obvious that you're not going to perform at a level that you might expect, and you may not achieve, you know, you may not achieve a trained status in that task, right? So, look, I don't think it's a balance. I think that there has to be an unbalanced focus, maybe moving forward, in truly getting after the individual soldier readiness, whether that's a technical skill set within, you know, it depends on the warfighting function or MOS, or whether it's individual soldier tasks. Every soldier's got to be fundamentally trained at to a certain level before you move on to the next thing, because you end up performing. It's obvious, right? You end up performing at a lower right. capability the more you undo the stuff before then. And if you try and balance equally the amount of time you spend at the squad that you do at the, you know, the brigade, you know, staff level, then you're going to end up, there's not going to be enough time to build the foundational building blocks. So as that relates to H2F, we got to get serious about H2F. We got to get serious about 722. We as leaders have got to dig into that doctrine and understand how to implement. It's directive in nature. We've got to implement that into our training methodologies and just make it the way that it is. Because your performance, if theoretically it's all you know, sound, right, then the performance at every echelon, whether it's the individual, the squad, the platoon, company, and beyond, will improve because of that investment of time in those foundational things. So I think H2F is foundational. I think it's critical. I truly believe that it's transformational. We have already studies in the Army that are showing improvements in things that are measured, you know, harmful behaviors are reduced in units that have H2F capabilities, as an example. We got to do it. We just have to make sure we focus on these things in order to be, you know, like maybe you only get to the company level of collective training, but you're going to be dang good at it, mm-hmm. I think. And I think that most senior leaders, you know, I think I'm parroting what I hear most of our senior leaders saying, and that is, you know, focus on the fundamentals, focus on the basics, and we'll underwrite, you know, some of those other, you know, exquisite capabilities at the higher echelons. That's what we said at the division level. So, again, I guess the end of my story, I dragged all the SAR majors and first sergeants into what we called a pre-SATB, and I forced them to actually have to overlay the individual, the crew, and the squad training requirements with the training plan that their commander was going to lay out and talk us through what we were going to be able to get done with the resources we had. And what the real readiness picture looked like. And doing that, you know, at least in the meeting when you know, the sergeant major would get, you know, the battalion CSM would get 5 minutes to talk about sergeant's time training. At least he didn't even need that 5 minutes. You know, a thumbs up. All the commanders knew that we had just spent 3 or 4 hours talking these requirements, and that we're all in unison on, you know, where we were accepting risk or where we were advising our commanders that they were accepting risk in doing or not doing some of the things that we know have to get done. I wish we didn't have to make that value proposition, but, you know, I think we got to be realistic. Every commander's got to make that decision at echelon on what they are or are not able to accomplish. But I don't think that we can mortgage, you know, the individual capabilities of our soldiers and their training requirements in order to get there, which includes H2F.
Is there anything else you'd like to add? Parting thoughts?
No. So like last time, I just appreciate the opportunity to talk about this topic in particular. I asked to talk about this topic. I think it's really important. I think we've written a great book. Not we, but, you know, we, the collective we, you know, the experts and the scientists and all the folks that contributed to 722. What I hope is, you know, hope's kind of weak, but I'm going to use it anyway because in context, I'll try and make it make sense. What I hope is that in practice, we'll help inform the constant adaptation of that manual, because I think there's a lot of emerging science and technology in this space that if we're not on top of it, we'll lose the ball, and then we'll become irrelevant in that manual, in that space, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that it's critical that we get and continue to get the feedback from the operating force as it relates to the, you know, the efficiency or efficacy of H2F in action, right? Because that's got to shape the way we move forward. I think we can't just rest on, okay, we got a great book, we've got capabilities fielded to the force, we've got a new PT test. I think we gotta figure out how, and this is probably the work of those brigades that have H2F teams, we gotta be able to quantify those results and provide that feedback to the Army to make sure that we're moving in the right direction. And where things change, we need our experts within, you know, our military enterprise, our dietitians, our, you know, our medical professionals, our physical therapists, to help us stay engaged with the most current science so that we can continue to update our manuals, particularly 722, with the most recent, most current knowledge and information.
Great. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Just like writing new doctors in the team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and special doctrine division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you the show. Our production is coordinated by Mr. Ted Crisco, and our editing and sound is provided by Captain Wyatt Harper and 29 Pixels. Please don't forget to subscribe on Google, Apple, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications.